Doğru, ben de bir şey bir şey şu şey. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 71, The Lord Travels to Indraprastha. We're covering quite a few verses today, 16 through 28. I'm going to mainly focus on the verse in purport to text 24. So I'm going to just read the English through all of these, then go back and we'll do 24 Sanskrit in response. Okay? So starting with text 16. On all sides proceeded finely adorned women, attendants of the royal household, as well as courtesans. They rode on palanquins and camels, bulls and buffalo, donkeys, mules, bullock carts, and elephants. Their conveyances were fully loaded with grass tents, blankets, clothes, and other items for the trip. Before, Sri Vishnu Chakravarti explains the household attendants mentioned here included washerwomen and other helpers. 17. The Lord's army boasted royal umbrellas, chamra fans, and huge black bulls with waving banners. During the day, the sun's rays reflected brightly from the soldiers' fine weapons, jewelry, helmets, and armor. Thus, Lord Krishna's army, noisy with shouts and clatter, appeared like an ocean stirring with agitated waves and panjala fish. Honored by Sri Krishna, the sheep of the Yadus, Narada Muni, bowed down to the Lord. All of Narada's senses were satisfied by his meeting with Lord Krishna. Thus, having heard the decision of the Lord and having been worshipped by him, Narada placed him firmly within his heart and departed through the sky. With pleasing words, the Lord addressed the messenger sent by the king. My dear messenger, I wish all good fortune to you. I shall arrange for the killing of the king of Magadha. Do not fear. Report, the statement, Ma Vashishta, do not fear, is in the plural, being intended for both the messenger and the king. Similarly, the expression, Bhadram Va, blessings unto you, is also in the plural, expressing a similar intent. 20. Thus addressed, the messenger departed and accurately relayed the Lord's messages to the kings. Eager for freedom, they then waited expectantly for their meeting with Lord Krishna. Report. The great Vaishnav scholar Srila Jiva Goswami comments here that by force of circumstances, the king began focusing their attention on Lord Krishna alone. As he traveled through the provinces of Anartha, Salvira, Maradesh, and Dhanashina, Lord Hari crossed rivers and passed mountains, cities, villages, cow pastures, and quarries. After crossing the rivers Rishvati and Saraswati, he passed through Panchala and Matsya and finally came to Indraprastha. King Yudhisthira was delighted to hear that the Lord, whom human beings rarely see, had now arrived. Accompanied by his priests and their associates, the king came out to meet Lord Krishna. Text 24. The songs and musical instruments resounded along with a loud vibration of Vedic hymns. The king went forth with great reverence to meet Lord Hrishikesh, just as the senses go forth to meet the consciousness and life. I'll come back to you. 25. The heart of King Yudhisthira melted with affection when he saw his dearmost friend, Lord Krishna, after such a long separation, and he embraced the Lord again and again. The eternal form of Lord Krishna is everlasting residence of the goddess of fortune. As soon as King Yudhisthira embraced him, the king became free of all contamination of material existence. He immediately felt the transcendental bliss emerge in an ocean of happiness. There were tears in his eyes, and his body shook due to ecstasy. He completely forgot that he was living in this material world. Report above translations taken from Srila Prabhupada's Krishna. Then Bhima, his eyes brimming with tears, laughed with joy as he embraced his maternal cousin Krishna. Arjuna and the twins, Nakula and Sahadeva, also joyfully embraced their dearest friend, infallible Lord, and they cried profusely. After Arjuna had embraced him once more, Nakula and Sahadeva had offered him their obeisances, Lord Krishna bowed down to the Brahmins, and the elders present was properly honoring the respectable members of the Kuru, Srinjaya, and Kaitaya clans. Report, Sridhar Swami mentioned that since Arjuna was considered Lord Krishna's social equal, when Arjuna tried to bow down to him, Lord Krishna held Arjuna by his arms so he could only embrace him. The twins, however, being junior cousins, bowed down and grasped Lord Krishna's feet. Let's go back to text 24. Okay, we'll do this responsibly. Gita Vaditra Goshena Brahma Goshena Bhuyasa Abhyayatsa Hrishikesham Vana Prana Mivadrita Gita Vaditra Goshena Brahma Goshena Bhuyasa Abhyayatsa Hrishikesham Prana Prana Mivadrita Gita Vaditra Goshena Brahma Goshena Bhuyasa Abhyayatsa Hrishikesham Prana Prana Mivadrita. Gita of song, Vaditra, an instrumental music, Goshena, with the sound, Brahma of the Vedas, Goshena, with the sound, Bhuyasa, abundant, Abhyayat, went forth. To Lord Krishna, prana, the senses, pranam, consciousness or the air of life, eva, as, adrita, reverential. Translation purport by disciples of Srila Prabhupada. As songs and musical instruments resounded along with the loud vibration of Vedic hymns, the king went forth with great reverence to meet Lord Hrishikesh, just as the senses go forth to meet the consciousness of God. Report. Lord Krishna is here described as Hrishikesh, the Lord of the senses, and King Yudhisthira rushing to the Lord is compared to the senses eagerly joining the consciousness of life. Without consciousness, the senses are useless. Indeed, the senses function through consciousness. Similarly, when the individual souls are bereft of Krishna consciousness, love of God, they enter into a useless and illusory struggle for all material existence. Pure devotees like King Yudhisthira are never bereft of the Lord's association, for they keep him always within their hearts. And yet they feel special ecstasy when they see the Lord at the long separation as described here. I'm Jonathan Rambashe, and I'm Jeanette Sinatologist. Why don't you call the teacher staff, keep us in the room, and talk about the kind of problem you have in school. So, an interesting verse in purport. The main points here seem to be that our senses are dependent upon consciousness, and also that consciousness is dependent upon Krishna. Of course, Krishna is Rishi Purush, the master of the senses. Then another point here is that advanced devotees see Krishna both within and without. And a corollary idea of that is that we may appreciate externally in Krishna, internally in Krishna, and also, of course, the guru and advanced devotees. We have this idea of Vani and Bhakti, that the spiritual master is appreciated both in his physical form and also in his words. So this is kind of an interesting, complicated analogy. As you know, an analogy compares one thing to another. It takes something familiar and compares it to something less familiar. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is filled with analogies and all sorts of literary devices. There's that whole chapter, you may recall, in the 10th canto of the description of Vrindavan in autumn. You know, it's filled with these analogies, like glowworms, lightning. In other words, so many material elements are compared to spiritual principles so that we can more easily understand them. Now, in this case, it's the principle that is being compared, the analogy is not quite so easy to understand. I think in the Srimad Bhagavatam assumes a fairly sophisticated, educated audience that would be very familiar with things like, you know, in other words, Yudhishthira's rushing to see Krishna is just like the senses going forth to meet the consciousness of life. Not quite so clear, is it? In other words, the senses coming forward to see the consciousness of life assumes that we know a certain amount about the senses, about the body, about the subtle body, the gross body, and about consciousness. So it is somewhat of a complicated analogy, but basically it's saying that all of our senses are dependent upon consciousness. And of course, the living entity is dependent upon the master of the senses, Krishna, Rishikesh. So the senses would be inert or lifeless without consciousness. Consciousness is what is behind everything that animates the living entity, the mind, intelligence, ego, the subtle body. Everything is there as a result of consciousness. I thought I was looking for some statements Prabhupada made to explain consciousness a little bit more. And there's a nice room conversation I found where Srila Prabhupada is talking to Sri Damodar and some of the Bhaktivedanta Institute scientists. And the subject matter is consciousness. It was interesting because then I looked and I thought this was really interesting, and I saw that the date was July 6, 1976. What's interesting about that? Well, I was actually there in that conversation. I'd forgotten, you know, that, oh, that's why this seems somewhat familiar, but of course I didn't remember a lot of the details. But somehow or another, I guess I was there and I heard some of this. You know. So anyway, this is kind of interesting. Srupa Damodar was saying, still in this verse, 7:26, verse 14, Bhagavatam, it says there are four internal subtle senses. Now, this is kind of interesting because we always hear that there's the three subtle senses, mind, intelligence, and ego. That's the verse in the Bhagavad Gita, 7th chapter. But this Bhagavatam verse says there's a fourth. It says the internal subtle senses are experienced as having four aspects in the shape of mind, intelligence, ego, and contaminated consciousness. Distinctions between them are made only by different functions since they represent different characteristics. And then they read Srila Prabhupada's purport. He says, the four internal senses or subtle senses described herein are defined by different characteristics. When pure consciousness is polluted by material contamination and identification with the body becomes predominant, that is called false ego. Consciousness is the function of the soul, and therefore, behind consciousness, there is soul. And consciousness is polluted by material contamination. This is called ahankar, false ego. So consciousness is not exactly the same as the soul, but it is coming from the soul. Then Rupanuga says, so the consciousness can be contaminated according to the modes of which it's associating. I've added to the key, this is the quite a bit. This is a very long conversation. Rama says, yes, Prakriti Jan Gunan. Sridhamata. Actually, consciousness is a symptom of life. So when we say contaminated consciousness, the quality of life is there, but somehow, that is mixed with material modes. Yes. Originally, it is goodness, pure goodness. You say everything in the beginning is Prabhupada. I give the example. This is a very good analogy that Prabhupada gives about how consciousness mixes with the modes of nature. He says, just like water falling from the sky, it is crystal clear, distilled water. But as soon as it touches the earth, it becomes muddy. But that muddiness can be filtered. Rupanuga says, plus muddiness is the character of the mud, not the consciousness, and it can be cleansed, filtered out. Prabhupada, yes. That filtering process is devotional service. So unless the water is different from the precipitated matter, how can it be filtered? So what we can understand from this is that consciousness is a symptom of life. Consciousness is the original, is coming from the soul, and it's originally pure and uncontaminated. But it becomes contaminated by mixing with the material modes of nature. So in contact with material energy, our consciousness becomes polluted. It is not the consciousness itself that is exactly changed, but it is mixed and covered, contaminated by these other elements. And as is described, that one can filter out that. Service, as Prabhupada said, is the filtering process of bringing to consciousness. And of course, going back to senses, there they meant verses we all know regarding this, is Prabhupada Prabhupada, and it is some of Prabhupada, and Bhakti, the devotional service, means engaging all of our senses.
faith in the God. Look at what he said to me this morning. Never did that.
But what might be more analogous? Okay, gosh, something I was thinking about. I feel like it's pretty good. And in certain ways, and certain different meetings, something that you can actually do. So, you pray to them. I was going to say you have pictures of them, but you're probably on your phone or on your computer. You might have deity photos that you look at, but it's not quite the same. I mean, it's when you come back and you see when the curtains open and you see the deities right before you. So yes, the deities are in your heart. You appreciate the deities in so many ways. You can pray to them, but it's particularly relishable when you see Radhashyama Sundar, Krishna Balaram, and Goni Kai before you, dressed wonderfully like that. I think another example, we can see our relationship with Srila Prabhupada. Relationship with the Guru is somewhat like that. Obviously, Prabhupada is in our hearts. We can pray to Prabhupada. We can feel his presence. And we associate with the spiritual master through his words. Prabhupada's words are non-different than him. And we are reading Srila Prabhupada's purports. We are connecting with him. We are associating with him. We are hearing his instructions directly. And at the same time, there is something a little bit special about the physical proximity, about actually seeing, and we all remember, those of us who are Prabhupada's disciples, and when Prabhupada was here, we so much wanted to see him. People would travel all over to see Srila Prabhupada, right? You know, it's like these little temples, just 10 devotees. Someone was saying the other day, what was it, Los Angeles? Someone was talking about and like 200 devotees showed up there or something like that. Oh, Mahatma was talking about that, but it was probably like one-third of the devotees in the movement somehow showed up there in Los Angeles and probably said, you know, I used to do that. I used to go on traveling Sankirtan out of Miami in the 70s, and somehow or another, you know, our route across the United States would just coincidentally end up in those places where Srila Prabhupada was, you know, Philadelphia, New York, or wherever it might be. So we all relish that relationship of seeing Srila Prabhupada. I was even thinking, as an example of my appreciation for this that room talk that I was reading earlier. Now, if I just read that in the in the database, it'd be really nice. And oh, that's a great thing. I could talk about that in class. But the fact that I was there and I kind of remember some of what Prabhupada said and how he said it, some of his expressions, it just particularly relishable. You know, I was thinking that when Prabhupada was talking with the scientists, they had, you know, certain conceptions that they had, and Prabhupada would often surprise them, you know, by giving us information we hadn't heard before. And actually, if you go back and look at these conversations I did recently, and it was, in some of the parts I didn't remember very well, like when Sri Damodar, he wasn't Maharaj at that point, he was Brahmachari, and Sri Damodar Prabhu was talking about, he was giving examples of the difference between life and non-life. And he was saying living things have these symptoms, non-living things don't have these symptoms. He gave an example like rocks and stones as non-living things. And Prabhupada said, oh, sometimes rocks have souls. And it's kind of like they all stop, whoops, and let's go back. And he said, mountains often have souls. They exhibit symptoms of life. A mountain actually gets formed at some point geologically, the scientists would say, right? But it grows, it sustains for some time. Most of the different parts. And they said, but if you pick up a rock, it doesn't seem to have any symptoms of life. And Prabhupada said, oh, well, it may be dead now. In other words, it had a soul, but the soul is gone. You just have to go in the forest. There's all these trees that have a soul, but you see a tree that's fallen over and rotting, the log, soul's left, you know, the body of the tree. You know, so in other words, yeah, most of the souls have left, most of the rocks and mountains like that, but they originally did at some point. So, I mean, these were the kind of things that were just always amazing to Srila Prabhupada. We would learn things that we never knew or hadn't thought about in the same way. And he was continually giving us new perspectives on things. And that was some of the things that were particularly relishable about when we had an opportunity to see Srila Prabhupada. You never knew what you were going to hear or experience. Or sometimes just, it can just be very, very small interactions that are very enlivening and just very wonderful. And, you know, I remember the very few times I had association with Srila Prabhupada, you know, I wasn't a disciple or anything. But the point is, they were very, very meaningful to me. When I try to tell the story of what transpired, it's not really that significant or inspiring or anything particularly notable. But of course, to me, it was very, very important because, you know, it was just, you know, maybe. So, at any rate, we have internal and external relationships in the world. Both internal and external. Although, most of us are not that yet at that stage when we get to see Krishna in our dreams. But still, we should learn to see Krishna in these different ways. Prabhupada has a very, very nice discussion. A little book called On the Way to Krishna, one of my favorite. But it's very nice, and it's a chapter 3, it's called Seeing Krishna in the Mind. And Prabhupada is talking about the verse from the Bhagavad Gita about the Krishna of the Mind. I think it's 7-8, where Krishna can undertake water, and as we go through, you know, and his mantras, and the illumination of the sun, you know, he gives, again, some analogies, some examples, you know, of how you can understand Krishna, and even through the elements. And the prophet says, actually, this is from On the Way to Krishna, it's not directly the book, but it's from the prophet says, in this verse, Sri Krishna is describing how we can become Krishna conscious fully in all stages of life. All living entities must be taught. Taste the water so nice that we are thirsty. Nothing but water comes to you. You can thus remember Krishna or God and water. No one can avoid drinking water every day of his life. That consciousness is there. How can you do that? So, very nice example. Baba gives me another example. Then at the last part of that happens, there are 9 different processes for associating with God. And the first method of association is shavana. Inasmuch as we associate with God and belong doing the words of Krishna and his names, the contamination of the two nations is reduced. And understanding that Krishna is sound, animation, water, and so many other things, it becomes impossible to avoid Krishna. If we can remember Krishna this way, our association with him is coming. So, very nice way to understand how we can everything be reminded of Krishna. When we are even in the material world, seeing the material elements, those things we can reflect upon. How those things are Krishna. How Krishna is everywhere and all. So, Prabhupada recommends that the way that we're going to have a consciousness, the way that we're going to see Krishna more and more in our life, is in the 9 processes associated with God, beginning to travel on the earth. So, devotion. We can't see Krishna intellectually, we can't do some mental process to see Krishna, we can't, you know, through the force of will to see Krishna, we can only see worship your vendor is finally revealed to Shama Sunya. Krishna himself is inconceivable, innumerable actors, whom the pure devotees see in the heart of hearts. Our devotion changed to the past. See, these are only givers. So poetic. You see, in the heart of hearts, the final devotion changed to the past. And took what if the eye of devotion is nothing but the eye of pure and unveiled spiritual self, the form of Krishna is visible to that eye in proportion to its purification and practice of devotion. The devotion of the neophyte is the stage of Bhavabhakti, the pure eye of that devotee is changed to and the grace of Krishna, which enables him to see Krishna's face to face. So immediately the Bhava the grace in their hearts makes Krishna visible in proportion as their hearts are purified by the practice. Some subject of the sloka, the form of Krishna is not a mental impression, but is transcendental and is visible to the mind, soul. So, of course, Sri Prabhupada also famously quoted to the word as, don't try to be Krishna unless Krishna is through you. So, to gain the vision, seeing Krishna within the heart, the eye of devotion, within the heart, is not something that is done visually, it's done with pure revelation, no doubt. Gradually, step by step, conscious, and Krishna see you by his service, in proportion proportionally to the purification, Krishna.
Prabhu, in
Chandi wrote in a very rich and systematic book that he wrote. The Acharyas are very present in the samadhi. And then I personal experience, you know, in Vrindavan conflict orders, if you have ever heard of any of the references or statements about that, but he doesn't really give any reference to it, he just says it.
You mean in reference to the Acharyas being particularly present in the samadhi?
Yeah.
He doesn't have any particular references on that man. I mean, obviously, in the sense, as you said, he could feel that. I mean, you're in the Holy Dhamma, you can do it.
Actually, just thought of something. I mean, the Prabhupada, he got a Dhamma dress. I think described that many of, practically all of the realizations start this time.
Coming back to the point of consciousness, I think this is the fundamental difference between us and science. But we can't touch or even discover consciousness. So we try to manipulate matter in all different ways, even try to produce life. But because life is not matter, not compromised, then they'll be ending up in problems. And so, just put out their theories that actually life comes from us. The whole world is going on.
Actually, consciousness is somewhat of a psychological. Philosophical boundary for those who are atheistic and those who are materialistic who don't see even higher, because it's very hard to explain consciousness, isn't it? And to materialize, especially when you consider, in other words, if you really are thinking all of this come around combination chemicals, gradual evolution, start to meet those with the way of human beings, and then you think about even within the material realm, consciousness, you know, the complexity of philosophy, of literature, how do you possibly explain all of these elements of consciousness, you know, coming from nothing, coming from matter? What to speak of more evolved spiritual and the realizations there of
this conversation. I think it is a relative meaning that I can go with that. If you find the maybe I can make it so. Not Krishna, so. I think relative meaning is this table in front of you. Is says soul to me, so yes. So at that point I could unlearn everything I can. If I'm not sure I understand anything, because Krishna separates the material and the human energy, which is like the weakness of the soul.
Now, it's interesting because obviously we know that there is material energy. Right? There is inert material energy. And it becomes activated and animated by the presence of the spirit. The presence of the spirit. So, also, you know, Prabhupada said that the super soul is within every atom and between every atom. So, even there's no reason the soul couldn't be within an atom and the super soul can be within an atom. But I hadn't actually heard that. We know there's sort of cell, practically, you know, and it usually things that we associate with life sentence. We consider that it's the soul that is, you know, giving this life sentence. Like, where did you say this problem got from that? I'd like to hear that.
Maybe I didn't give it to you. My first question is on this. It is a room conversation.
If you find it, send it to me. I'd like to see what happens. That's what happens. Oh, I'm sorry, was it?
Can I have the lady? I'm sorry, what is the question?
I have a question. You're speaking about the mountains and the rocks like that. And on the way to the library, there's a mountain there, and I don't know for sure if this is true, but I've heard it's really true. It should have called us when he was passing by there, he pointed out that mountain, and said it was previously a flying mountain, and that Lord Indra took away the power of the flying mountain because he was land. It would kill so many people or something.
I did hear about flying mountains, and I heard the Prabhupada talk about a mountain. I don't remember that it was that specific on getting out of here, but I do remember talking about it. Oh, you know the mountain? Okay. So it's there. I think you mentioned the Bhagavatam was flying mountain. It must be only on other planets.
This is just a quick story that I heard that I thought might be nice to do with relating to the physical presence and the importance of it. To me, like you were saying, with the story of the Sri Kamala, I know all because you have some time. I spent some time with the Bhatsu before he left his body in the hospital, and he told me a story that he said that he used to go take lunch in the New York temple. Just because it was cool, Prasadam, he didn't know it was Prasadam, he just thought it was a little bit vegetarian food, he was getting into this whole organic thing. So when he happened to work really close to us, he used to go to the temple every day to get lunch. Nothing more, just get lunch. It's cheap, it's easy, so he took the lunch. One day as he was leaving after his lunch, he was trying to make his way out to get back to work, and there was like a lot of devotees clamoring around. And he was like, he couldn't get out the door. And he was like, what's going on? And somebody says, oh, Prabhupada's coming. And he didn't even actually, he kind of knew, okay, this, he'd seen his picture and all that. But didn't mean a whole lot. He was still, I got to get back to work. And all of a sudden he got sort of boxed in a spot inside the temple. And he just saw all these sticks coming. And that's all he could see is all these sticks, and they were all devotees, and everyone started chanting, and he gets sort of pushed up against the wall. He says, I couldn't see who it was, but everyone's yelling, Jai Prabhupada, Jai Prabhupada. And he was like, but I could feel this presence. I could feel this presence. It's like, I didn't see him, but I could feel it. He says, then I started to think, maybe there's something to this more than just this nice vegetarian food. And he became a devotee basically just from Prabhupada. Presence. You didn't even see him, talk to him, anything. Just knew inside that sea of the sticks, the orange sticks. You know, they were sure to bog them.
Yeah, Prabhupada had a friend. On the first time I saw Sri Prabhupada in Yugoslavia in 1972, I heard him give class. I think I went there in a moment, but before. But I
This is our spiritual ministry. Church is ended.
Okay, I'm ready to hear from you.